this is not Vicky.
He knows what to say.
Okay. Yeah. If you're like me, the potato bread and mushroom soup is beginning to take hold. And so I promise not to talk for a long time. So this is the best nap time to talk about. So I don't want to cut into it too much, so my own included. I'm going to do what I was told to do last year. Every year I try to wrangle a trip to Pasahara, and usually I have to sing for my supper by giving some kind of talk. And last year somehow I wriggled out of it and didn't have to do it. So Michael Wenger, who usually works this scam for me every year, said, okay, now you owe us big time. So I'm going to give the talk that Michael Wenger told me to give last year. So you're getting warmed up leftovers on a warm afternoon. And that is a talk about one book called The Mountains and Waters Sutra. How many of you have heard of this book? Half or so. Would someone who's heard of it tell the rest of us what it is? How about a non-Vicky telling you? You guys are really serious about it. Can I get close to the... I'm not being broadcast. I'm only being recorded, I think. There are no speakers. But I could try to speak louder. Is that... You're hearing me? Yeah. Okay, I have to tell you myself, I guess, what the Mountains and Waters Sutra is. This is a text written in 1240 by the founder of the monastic order that created, ultimately, Pasahara, that is to say, Soto Zen, a man named Dogen. It's one of the texts of a whole bunch, up to 95, that he wrote over a long period of time, mostly commenting on Zen stories that he had read in Chinese Zen books when he was a pilgrim and thereafter. He was a pilgrim to China for 4 years and picked up a lot of Zen books and became really, I think probably it's fair to say, the first Japanese who read seriously the Zen books that we now take for granted. All the stories of the masters, the sayings of the masters, and so on. Japanese had been Buddhists for centuries, but they hadn't read that material. And Dogen went to China, studied in a monastery there for 4 years, came back, created his own monastery, maybe the first Zen monastery, that is to say, monastery devoted solely to Zen practice in Japan. And then started teaching these stories that he had read in the literature in the form of very interesting essays and commentaries. And one of these is this book that Michael likes, The Mountains and Waters Sutra. It's not been clear to me, Michael's been haranguing me about this for the last 2 years, and it's not clear to me that he actually likes this book. I think what he likes about it is the history of its transmission into English. That is, when I was a graduate student at Berkeley back in the early 70s, and studying with Suzuki Roshi, the founder of this monastery, I was looking for a topic to write about for my master's thesis, and Suzuki Roshi said, why don't you do this text, The Mountains and Waters Sutra? He said, I love this text, and I would love to have an English translation of it and then give a series of lectures. And last year, you know, Gil Fransdahl set up a conference about the life of Suzuki Roshi that got a lot of us remembering him, thinking about him again, and got Michael interested in getting me to talk about what it was like working with Suzuki Roshi to translate this Mountains and Waters Sutra, which we did here at Pasahara the last summer that Suzuki Roshi was down here. And then he got sick during that summer, and as you know, he passed away that year. That's all I had to tell Michael about the experience of working with Suzuki Roshi, just that it was much nicer doing that than digging the latrines up there for the hill cabin, which I had done the summer before. But in any case, because of that a kind of wave of nostalgia that went through a lot of us about Suzuki Doshi, this book and the time in which I translated came back to me. And coincidentally, at the same time, one of my graduate students was doing a dissertation on the American Buddhist poet Gary Snyder, who had just published a couple years ago a big, I mean, for a poet, big book, long book, called Mountains and Rivers Without End, that he had begun back in the 50s and worked through all these years and finally brought it out. And so this graduate student organized a seminar on Gary Snyder, brought him to Stanford, and brought Gary down to Stanford to do a reading, a long reading, to a packed house at Stanford. We were amazed that young Stanford students would even know who Gary Snyder was. I mean, it wasn't just old hippies in the audience. There were a lot of young, 500 people in the audience for this. And at that point, Gary said that in the early 70s, when Dick Baker gave him the translation that I had done down here of Mountains and Waters Sutra, it set him back 10 years. Because what was in that thing was so problematic and so juicy for his topic of mountains and rivers without end that he set to brooding about it. Well, he's probably exaggerating. After all, he was going through several wives. He was setting up his place in the Sierras. He had other things to do besides sit and read my MA thesis. But still, that then dragged me back into this text. And I had to give a lecture about Mountains and Water Sutra and its relationship to Gary Snyder's poetry, which I did then. And then it got, maybe some of you have seen this. It's an advertisement for the Zen Quarterly. Did you get that at Sasahara?
Yeah.
Well, the latest issue, hot off the press, the Zen Quarterly, has the paper that I gave there and then gave a different version in Korea, and then finally it ended up in this magazine. And what I did here is very different from what I did at Stanford or what I would do here, obviously. But anyway, I got... Somehow my karma has come around from over a quarter of a century, during which I never thought about this book. Suddenly, it's in my face. And so Michael wanted me to talk about it. Not only Gary Snyder and Michael, perhaps, and Carl, certainly, but lots of people seem to love this particular book of the Shobogenzo. I still get email from people who say, I came across an old Xerox of your MA thesis, and it was extraordinarily inspiring to me. And some people say to me, this is their favorite book in all of Dogen's writing. I don't know that I understand why that is. Probably each person has his own reasons for it. But I think one reason is that it talks about a subject for which we are hungry as Buddhists, and especially as American Buddhists. It talks about nature and the natural world. And I think many of us have a feeling that one of the things that Buddhism can offer us is a different take on nature, a healthier take on nature than many of the ones that seem to have been our heritage in the Western tradition. The standard thing that I think you see a lot, both in books and you hear in conversation, is that unlike the Christians, who thought that nature was a kind of playground for human beings, created for us to do with what we will, the Buddhists had a healthier attitude towards nature, in which we were only part of a larger system, and not necessarily the most important part. And that we had to find a way to fit into that system, a non-destructive, healthy way to live in nature, to come to terms with nature, and not simply think that we can exploit it, use it for what we will, eat it, whatever, and take it for granted. And so Buddhism has come increasingly over the last decade or so to be a player in talk about ecology, environmentalism, animal rights, and so on. But when we look around at Buddhist scriptures for a validation of that sense we have of Buddhism, it's not easy to find. You do not find many Buddhist scriptures that talk about what we would call the broad category of nature. But Dogen does. Now, exactly how we define that broad category could be subject to lots of debate, even our own, let alone the Buddhists. notions of nature are very complicated. Everything from the natural world studied by physicists to the nature of nature romanticism and of ecology and so on. There are lots of different senses of nature. But when we look for any of those senses, they're still, I think, pretty hard to find within the traditional Buddhist corpus. But here we have a Zen master, and we know Zen masters are supposed to be, of all Buddhists in a way, the ones who love nature. We have a Zen master, a rare case of a Zen master talking about nature. And that's attractive. Clinger. Ah, finally, I have validation for what I thought Buddhists always talked about. Here's one that actually does. Like feminists looking for a feminist view in Buddhism, and they find something, they cling to that and ignore that 90% or 99% of trashing women that goes on in Buddhism. But yeah, the Buddhist. The question is then, one of our questions should be, I think, as Buddhists, to what extent we are generating a view of nature for Buddhists. If we are Buddhists, we're, seems to me, within our right to generate a Buddhist view of nature, even if we don't find it in the scripture. That's what Buddhists have always done. And if necessary, they've created their own scriptures and attributed to the Buddha, saying, this is what the Buddha said at such and such a time, and it happens to agree exactly with what I think. And I think we're well within our rights to do that. In other words, I'm not saying because we don't find much validation for ecology or environmentalism in the Buddhist scriptures that therefore we can't speak as Buddhists about a Buddhist view of it. That I think we have to do. We ought to do. And we're in our rights to do it. Still, it's very nice to have a few examples of enlightened people who actually agree with us. It's not clear from this, those of you who have read it may wonder whether, in fact, Dogen does agree with much of what we think of nature, and that's what I want to talk about, some of the ways he thinks about it. But still, in comparison with, certainly with Indian Buddhist scriptures, we're, say, in comparison with psychology, various kinds of philosophy, in which the Indian scriptures are very rich, on this particular category of nature that we're interested in, they're very weak. In fact, probably the Indians didn't have any category, as most people did not have any category, quite corresponding to what we call nature. And when you see the way they look at nature, now, of course, it's not fair to categorize an entire civilization by saying the Indians think X, but still, there's an enormous amount of material from Indian Buddhism, very little of which deals with nature, and when we look for things that we would think of as nature, it's often treated in a very negative way. A way that is at least as empty of spiritual value, you might say, as much in Christian stuff. The Indian Buddhists seem especially interested in subjectivity. That is to say, in the life of the consciousness. And to that extent, they tended to see the natural world, indeed everything around them, as the object of consciousness. What was happening to us? What was impinging on our consciousness? For example, in meditation practice, rather than have meditations about the beauties and glories of the natural world, it was, this is a red color now impinging itself on my consciousness. This is a sound now coming to me. In other words, they broke down the world into things that affected subjectivity and saw, in effect, sort of neutralized the rest of the world of its values independent of its relationship to what was happening to us. And when they talk about, you can see an example of this in the way that they talk about karma. And they say there are two basic kinds of karma for each individual. That which constitutes your, what we might call personality, structure of your own person, and that which constitutes your environment. And here the environment is being reduced down to what it is that you are stuck with in your life as a human being, the sorts of things that will impinge upon you. Rather than dividing it up into this is natural, this is cultural, and other sorts of, it was all lumped into what happened to you from the outside or the place where you happen to find yourself. So in that sense, being in the middle of San Francisco being down at Tassajara, there's no difference, you know, fundamental difference in the way, in the attitude towards them. So it doesn't present, then, a worldview in which it's likely we would see a lot of emphasis put on the value of nature and the meaning of nature. When you come to the Chinese case, it's somewhat different. As Buddhism left India about the beginning of the Common Era, came into China, into a culture that had much less interest in this issue of subject versus object as a way of dividing up the world. They did have, when Buddhism came in, a great interest in something that's in a way somewhat more familiar to us, and that is culture and nature. They saw human beings as living in an environment and participating in an environment that was made up of the natural world and the cultural activities of human beings. And so they had a sense, as I say, somewhat akin to much of what we think of when we think of nature versus culture, of human constructs and the natural environment within which this is taking place. And so the Buddhists, who didn't really emphasize that kind of distinction when they came in, began to fit their way of talking about Buddhism into that construct. In Chinese civilization, you see it most clearly, the sort of tension between those two in the Confucian tradition, which emphasizes the human world and man as a social being, and the Taoists, as they're called, those people who emphasize humans as natural beings, beings who have more in common with animals, right? Who basically like animals, and then on top of that, they create culture. And there's a kind of friendly rivalry that goes on throughout the history of Chinese culture between the Confucians and the Taoists. Most Chinese intellectuals, at least, are sort of both. They go to work in culture, and they take more human culture and society, civilization, morals seriously, and then on the weekend, so to speak, somewhat the way we do, they go and become Taoists. they relax and enjoy the landscape, write poetry, and make fun of the very activities that they did during the week. You probably recognize that kind of pattern. Many of us are down here precisely on that kind of trip. The Buddhists then fit themselves into that and sort of had a Confucian element, an elaborate scholastic element, developing Buddhist culture, art, philosophy, ritual, and a kind of Taoist element that is best represented by the Zen tradition, which aligned itself with what you might call the Taoist wing of this Chinese culture and tended to emphasize the natural versus the cultural. And so you see the sort of thing that for which Zen is famous, a rhetoric developing of making fun of all culture, including Buddhist culture. All that elaborate Buddhist philosophy, all its institutions, that's all just culture. Just the kind of human bullshit piled on top of the natural world. And as Buddhists, our job is not to get ourselves further into that and to manipulate that and become expert at that, but rather to see through it all, to let it go, to return, and that's a common metaphor, return to what is natural in us. And part of that means what is natural to us as conscious beings, our pre-cultural consciousness, pre-linguistic, pre-philosophical, pre-symbolic experience, when red is just red, as they say. They like to say in Zen, Buddhists see blue flowers as blue and green bamboo as green. That's it. That's all. In other words, before you add everything else, that sense of natural. And alongside that, a glorification of the natural or pre-cultural world of what we would call nature. Nature in the raw. Nature before it's been settled, civilized, organized, and to a certain extent, what? Destroyed. A kind of nostalgia for a lost innocence or primitivism that I think resonates with many of us. This style, Zen style, I think not so coincidentally, grows up within a context that is also familiar to us, namely the urbanization of Chinese culture. Who is nostalgic for for the landscape? The people who live in the city. Farmers do not get off, right, on dirt, right, and the natural thing. They want a more powerful tractor or something to handle it. But the people in the city who never get dirty, they're the ones who get off on the natural world. And it's a kind of nostalgia for the landscape, the lost innocence of the countryside in civilizations that are being urbanized. And that's what was happening in China. This style, Zen style, of what you might call a nature fetish, developed in the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, precisely at the time that historians say Chinese civilization was becoming urbanized. And there was growing up a considerable urban middle class intellectual society, the literati, who were involved in government, politics, and in the arts and letters. Those are the people from whom Zen Buddhists came. They're like the white middle class kids who become Zen Buddhists in this country. A particular stratum of society that has built into its culture a certain nostalgia for a lost innocence or landscape. And they are the ones then who glorified nature, really, I think for the first time in the history of Buddhism, who hung out with the landscape paintings that we often think of as Zen art. But in a way, you can say this was the nature art of a particular class to which Zen also belonged. Not necessarily that there was first Zen ideals and then there was Zen landscapes, but there were landscapes into which Zen Buddhists imagined themselves. They shared a certain set of values. So landscape painting and nature poetry, these sorts of elite literary and artistic expressions of a sense of longing for a pre-industrial, if you want, a pre-urban environment. Now, one of the things that happens in this way of thinking about nature is that the very artistic expressions of this longing or romance for nature become themselves called into question. After all, they're cultural artifacts. So you are doing a Confucian thing by celebrating a natural thing, a Taoist thing. Inevitably, you're being sucked into the other camp of culture whenever you speak out for nature. You're representing it. You're creating culture, you're creating artifacts, you're creating human symbols. And there's a very interesting tension then within all Zen speech that we're all familiar with, any of us who have read it, of apology for speaking. Silence is the best sermon. And everything we say is wrong. Don't believe any of what we say. The kind of liar's paradox. All of this is nonsense. All of this is just like, as they say, dust on the eyes. I think you're all familiar with that sense of self-suspicion of any kind of expression of value and judgment, even about that which is beyond or prior to value and judgment. So it's a very interesting, complicated business going on. Dogen goes over to China just at this time. He's a Japanese Buddhist trained in the traditional indoor, you might say, Buddhism of all the theology, the art, the ritual. And he goes into Zen monasteries and he reads books with this kind of nature romanticism, comes back to Japan, tries to establish a Zen tradition there, and starts himself writing books commenting on these very sayings and stories. Dogen, one of the things that's interesting to me about him is that he doesn't fit into any of our sort of preconceived models of what a Japanese Buddhist ought to be like, what a Zen Buddhist ought to be like. He has his own way. He's a genius. With a complex set of experiences of training in Japan, but also of another culture. And he is, like many of us, a convert from the kind of Buddhism he grew up with to a new form of Buddhism that he discovered in another culture. And like many of us, he is wrestling to bring those two experiences together and make something meaningful that would talk not only to himself, most lectures are probably in part for the person who's talking to convince themselves that they know what the hell they're talking about, but also for his students who were more or less in the same situation. To the extent that they were converting to Zen Buddhism, they had to give up a lot and take on a lot that they maybe didn't believe in, but anyway had to commit themselves to if they were going to practice. And so his lectures have a very interesting way of talking to us if we think about them in that historical context of someone struggling to create, in effect, a new religion that combines cultures. And it seems to me that this essay on mountains and waters is a very good example of this, a very difficult example, but a very rich and interesting example of this kind of wrestling with disparate cultures on a topic that really has very little precedent in previous Buddhist literature. I've almost talked for half an hour. That was the introduction. Huh? It's nap time. That's it. Okay, well, let me say very quickly what I had planned to say somewhat more leisurely, and that is, when I went back and looked at this sutra, now thinking about Gary Snyder, who's trying to create a literature, a Buddhist literature, that incorporates American and including Native American cultures with Buddhist cultures, trying to see what in this text that I had forgotten by this time might have been attractive to him. It seemed to me that there were at least three ways in which Dogen is talking about nature that are very interesting. They're in some tension with each other. I don't say it makes a seamless whole, but that's one of the reasons why they're very interesting. I just wanted to lay them out for you. For those of you who have read the text, see whether you recognize what I'm talking about. For those of you who haven't, but may in your next lifetime sit down with this text or be stuck on a desert island with only this text in it. One of those, Dogen says right at the very beginning, the title of the text is Mountains and Waters Sutra. And that's rather surprising. First of all, that he's talking about mountains and waters at all, because most sutras are called something like the sutra in which the god Brahma asked Shakyamuni to explain the doctrine of X or something. You know, it's kind of, it's all very technical or philosophical or symbolic type stuff. But here he says, this is a sutra about the landscape. So that's surprising. But even more surprising, Dogen, I mean, just an ordinary Buddhist, in some sense ordinary Buddhist, is going to write a sutra. After all, sutras are the words of the Buddha. What chutzpah, right? I'm going to sit down and write a new sutra. I mean, Buddhists did it, but they never admitted it. They always pretended that it had been translated from Sanskrit and had gone back. Well, but Dogen, in the very first line of this sutra, clears up at least part of that surprise, but adds another more interesting surprise. Namely, he says, in the very first line, the mountains and waters around us right now are the teachings of the ancient Buddha. In other words, I'm not writing a sutra. The mountains and waters are writing a sutra. We're speaking the sutra. The sutras were originally chanted. They still are chanted. So they're speaking to us. You can hear Tathagata Creek speaking to us. He's speaking not just about Tathagata Creek, he's speaking the Buddha Dharma all the time. And the mountains are doing so also. They're a sutra. They're a text that we can read as we walk about. As I say, that clears up the problem of genre. He's not writing a sutra, but it creates a much bigger problem that everything, at least in the natural world, is writing a sutra or speaking a sutra to it. But it's even more complicated than that, because what I just translated as the teachings of the Buddha is actually, in Japanese, ambiguous. What the term he uses is an expression of the way. Now, the way here, we know from the word Tao, as in the Tao of Poo. Maybe not the first thing you would think of, but that is to say, a juicy Chinese classical term and Buddhist term, the way, which had a whole range of meanings in itself. The mountains and waters are the expression of this way. Now, way means words or speech. That's one of its meanings. That's why I say you can understand that the mountains and rivers are speaking to. But it also means the way everything really is. When the Taoists talk about the Tao, they're talking about the way everything really is. before we mess with it, before we distort it, get confused about it. The reality itself. Mountains and rivers are expressing the way everything really is, the way we really are. Their existence is our existence. And then it also means the way you do things. The way of the Buddha. When he says it's expressing the way of the ancient Buddha, the way of the Buddha is a technical term in Buddhism, meaning the Buddhist path. Practice. So they're not just there blabbing about Buddhism. They are engaged in practice. Sasahara Sikh is practicing Buddhism as it's running past you. What the hell is that? So is it, right away, he is setting you up, you know, for what the hell are you talking about? And then the rest of the text is a very typical thing he does. He sets you up and says something incredible at the beginning, and then the rest of the text is, once he sets the hook, kind of, you know, and the rest of the text is getting you to try to see what he's talking about. And it seems to me the text goes through and in effect talks about these ambiguities in that very first sentence. It talks about what is really going on with mountains and waters, what they really are. He also talks about how they are expressing the symbolic world of Buddhism in their existence. And he talks about how they are practicing, or how you can understand Buddhist practice as the practice of mountains and rivers. When he talks about the way things really are, mountains and rivers, the way things really are, he's talking at a kind of metaphysical level that in some ways is the easiest for us to get at. He says, in order to introduce this kind of talk, he quotes one of the Zen masters from China who says, mountains are always walking. And then he says, what does this mean? And the way he talks about it, it's clear he is invoking in poetic terms something that we see in a lot of textbooks about Buddhism, namely, that everything is always changing. When the mountains are walking can be a kind of metaphor, not just for the sense we have when we're up on Chu's Ridge and we see the mountains, as it were, walking out to the ocean, but a metaphor for a Buddhist philosophical notion that everything, even the most permanent things around us, are constantly changing at every moment. They aren't things. They're events. Tiny, tiny events. Sort of like subatomic events going on constantly, all the time. If you've read any books about Buddhism, you've come across this doctrine of no self or impermanence. And he uses that to deconstruct, the way Buddhists like to do, the solidity of the mountains, and to give us a sense these things are alive in some sense. Going on, bang, 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 like that. The mountains and rivers of the present are actually becoming present in every moment. And implicitly, at least, urging us to get with that. That's the standard practice, right, for Zen Buddhists, to get with that. Bang, 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 in every moment. And stay with that. One of the standard things other people do while I'm sleeping up in the Zendo is to try to get into that moment. That's one level or layer or theme running through this text. That kind of analysis. But this is not, at first, when I first read this and I was trained as a graduate student in Buddhist doctrine, I thought, oh yeah, this whole thing is just a disguised philosophy, right? Dressed up with a lot of literary and artistic illusions. But now, in middle age, you know, when I kind of lost that Protestant urge for orthodox belief, I'm saying, why on earth would anyone dress up a philosophy with all that if they didn't take the artistic part seriously as part of the mountains and rivers? Why did I miss the fact that he said, they're actually speaking, they're actually practicing, and think that that was some sort of metaphor for something else that I had read in a Buddhist textbook? So then I began to look back and think, what if you took that stuff more seriously? And it seems to me there's another stream or strand running through this text of what you might call symbolic sense of nature. The nature is not just one damn thing happening after another. The nature is not just the emptiness of the self or the emptiness of the substance of the mountain. But that nature also is expressing a very rich symbolic world that the Buddhists live in. And here you see in the section, basically the text is divided into a section on mountains, a section on water, and then a section on mountains and water together, so it's mixed together at the end. And it seems to me when he shifts into the section on water, you really see a sense that he's not just talking Buddhist philosophy, he's also talking Buddhist cosmology, or a Buddhist mystical, a mystical sense that Buddhists had, especially the Buddhists in Japan, at the time that he grew up there and went off to China, in which the natural world is expressing a much deeper, hidden world of Buddhist symbols. The Japan that Dogen lived in was a world, a cosmological world, sort of like our medieval Catholic world, where everything that happened in this world was a kind of homology to, or correspondence to, something in the other world, the hidden world of the Buddha and the Bodhisattva, and the dead, and the spirit, and the dragon. Such that, for example, every part of our body belonged to some Buddha. Our body is like a mandala. Right? That is to say, a sacred diagram. And the parts of our body correspond to parts in that sacred vision, a kind of the sort of vision you could have in a contemplative state of the entire universe. So that our hands, our fingers, the joints of our fingers, every part of our body has a symbolic meaning. It belongs to Akshobhya, the Buddha of the East. I read the other day in something Gary Snyder sent me that feces is Vairocha. The Buddha Vairocha, the great sun Buddha. He sent me, he was over at my house, and so to thank me for my hospitality and my wife's hospitality, he sent us a tantric sex manual. And he said, I don't send this to everybody. You have to be married and middle-aged before you can do it. And I said, well, you came too late for me, Gary. If I did these things, I would injure something. I mean, you know, but in there you have this, you have all these symbolic correspondences, where the sex partner of the priest says, you know, eat my vairochana, and then there's a footnote that says feces, you know, and I'm like, oh, God, ugh. So everything, down to the feces, the piss, everything in our world had a symbolic meaning. And to master those symbolic meanings was to live in a world then that was a world of enlightenment, and not just of piss and shit, but of meaningful, rich, sacred piss. And Dogen lived in such a world. And that world was mapped on the landscape, not just on the human body, but on the landscape around. Every mountain in Japan is inhabited by God and represents some part of the sacred mandala, or chart, you might say, map of a hidden universe. Every path you go over in Japan, as you see in Tibet, you know, every path has some Om Mani Padme Hum and rocks to. Every path is guarded by a bodhisattva. Every cave is an entrance into some underworld. I mean, the whole land is inhabited by spirit. And a set of Buddhist meanings that were brought into Japan and laid over the landscape, mapped over the landscape. So that when you take a walk in Japan, you're not just walking, you know, in a pretty place or an ugly place or something. You are walking across a mandala, a sacred, and you are located in there. And you are a player in the sacred world. Wake up to that. Was one of the standard practices. Wake up to that, become that, and act that out in your body, speech, and thought, in everything you do. Dogen lived in that world. The Zen masters knew about that stuff, the Zen masters in China, but they weren't so interested. They were more interested in this, what you might call asymmetrical, flaky world of nature romanticism. But Dogen had that, this other symbolic, symmetrical world of Buddhist symbolism in his being, in his body when he went to China. And he came back and tried to fit those two together in a text like this. And I think in his practice, that's why there is so much ritual in Soto Zen. We may think, some people say, oh, that was just added on by a bunch of Japanese afterwards because they didn't understand true Zen. It was there from the very beginning. It was deeply, deeply important. How you moved, how you carried yourself, how you held your hands, how you put your hands in your pocket. All of that is meaningful. And that was built into Dogen's Zen, as it was into the Japanese Zen that he grew up with. So that's a second layer, as I'm saying, in this text. The natural landscape as symbolically enriched or enchanted. And then there's a third layer that is very dear to Dogen. And that is what you might call a mythological layer. That the landscape is not enchanted just by the sacred deities that sort of lurk behind it, but by its own history. And remember in that very first line, when he says, the mountains today, mountains and waters today, are the teachings of the ancient Buddha. Now, Ancient here can often mean a kind of metaphor for eternal. In other words, the eternal truths of the Buddha are being expressed in every moment. But it can also mean old. An old Buddha is a standard expression in Dogen's writing for all the practitioners who have come before us in the lineage of Zen, from the time of the Buddha up to our day. And in the last part of the text, he begins to invoke a landscape filled with the legendary figures of the past that enrich it and give it meaning. He talks about how the kings of ancient China went into the mountains in search of wisdom and met with Taoist sages who lived off in the mountains and took teachings from them. He talks about how Shakyamuni left the court of his father and went into the mountains to study Buddhism. He talks about Zen masters living in the mountains. He talks about a Zen master who was famous for having wandered, ended up as a boatman on a river, and then having taught Zen to his disciples, jumping into the river and disappearing, losing himself completely in nature, in a very literal sense. And then he goes on to say, this is not just, you know, a story about a Zen master. Everyone who practices in nature loses himself in nature. And you can never meet a Zen master when you go into the mountains and live. They're all living there, but you never meet them. Why? Because they have become one with the mountains and rivers. They don't stand out. They don't leave traces. There's just mountains and rivers practicing. And then he says, it's not that that Zen masters practice in the mountains. It's that the mountains and rivers are themselves practicing. The Zen masters jump into that practice, become that practice, and disappear. And so you have this sense that the landscape is, I mean, in one sense, this is a fantastic way of talking about the landscape as a sentient being. But it's also done so through the sense of merging the people who have inhabited the landscape with the landscape. And this was, when I was talking about Gary Snyder, this was very important for me because this is what Gary Snyder loves to do. You know, he wanders around in the Great Basin finding the old legends of the Indians who lived there. And I was thinking about this when my brother and I went up to see Suzuki Doshi's site up on the hill that I visit every time I come down here. And I realized these mountains and waters around here, you know, have a certain history already, even though we don't know the history of the Indians here. I mean, we can only imagine it. We can only imagine the 19th century Chinese who built the road in here and so on. Still, already there's a lore developing in these mountains and rivers that will be part of their meaning for us. I think for many of us already is part of their meaning, even though it's only a few decades old. But if all goes well and things aren't too impermanent, that sense of the mountains will grow. I mean, these are young mountains, okay? We're told the coast range, and it's a young Buddhism that's growing with these mountains. Until that historical sense of the landscape is going to become richer and richer and richer. Okay, I'm going to stop. That's 45 minutes.
Thank you.
Medieval Soto Zen, from the time of Dogen up to, say, 17th century. We're talking 500 years. Like virtually every kind of Buddhism in Japan, was deeply, deeply impregnated, you might say, with a sense of what we would loosely call tantric Buddhism, esoteric Buddhism, with very elaborate symbolic structures and ritual structures. And in the 18th century, there was not only in Soto Zen, but in many forms of Buddhism in Japan, there was an attempt to rationalize the tradition, to modernize it in effect. This is early modern period, sociologically, to demystify it, you might say. And so there was an attempt to weed out those elements that seemed extraneous to what was then perceived to be the authentic vision of Soto Zen that went back to Dogen and to China. So that many of the what we might call mystical or mythical or cosmological and ritual elements were dismissed as later accretions, often by people associated with the Eiheiji line of Soto Zen who blamed it on the Sojiji line and their founder Keizan. So you very often read Keizan mystified Dogen Zen. That's a kind of sectarian polemic we don't have to get into. I think it was there in the Japanese world, including Dogen's world, from the beginning. But there came a time when that medieval worldview, somewhat like our own Reformation, seemed the kind of natural law theory and so on that we turned against seemed no longer relevant, no longer appropriate. And it was a weaving, which was only exaggerated, of course, in the 19th century when it came on modern science and religion as a private, personal, spiritual experience as opposed to some ritual institution. So that now you have a sense that the social Zen pared down to being in the present moment and a lot of emphasis on internal experience, private experience, psychological experience, as opposed to the ritual symbolic world that was with pre-modern form. So and then if you ask what's the relationship between those two, then you'll have to develop a kind of meta-theory to put those two together. Yeah, I'd have to become a theologian and say, well, what's really going on there is, and then I would create a structure in which those two could be seen as two aspects of the same thing. That's better done by a Zen master who understands, you know, what would be helpful than by somebody just spinning his wheels like me. Does that help? That's a typical academic way out, right? You give it some, you explain it historically, and then you don't have to understand it. Right? First it was X, and then it was Y. You're taking mystical to mean Zen here, and walk around carrying your bowl in like this, like a Lotus Sutra. Huh? I mean, like a lotus flower. You know, lots of that stuff. And the same in Soto Zen, that deportment is itself political.
So,
and that, what does that mean? It means monkish ritual is itself the goal. To master, that's one way of reading, to master Buddhist behavior, or the behavior of a Buddha, is to be a Buddha. It's a behavioral modification program, or a ritual training program for priests.
Mm-hmm.
It's one way of understanding it. Not internal, but private. That's an extreme. Well, I see that as two reductions. It's not simply modifying your behavior. What I see for Dogen, now I don't want to speak for the history of Soto Zen, just from my own take on Dogen. He had a question. Right? Whether it's true or not that he actually had this question as a boy, I think it's appropriate that they said, as a boy, when he first was studying Buddhism, he had the question, look, everyone says we're already Buddhas. So, obviously, the goal of our religion is not to become Buddhas. What the hell is the goal of our religion? Why are we practicing Buddhism? Why do Buddhas themselves practice Buddhism? What's the point here of the religion if we already have what it is that is ostensibly the goal of the religion? And it's said that that led to his quest. Well, that's a question that arose for him not out of Zen Buddhism, although Zen Buddhism poses the same question for us. It arose out of his Japanese Buddhism. In effect, it's a question, what do I do now? That the thing I wanted out of my religion has been taken away from me because it's been given to me already. And I can no longer use that as the goal that I'm going after. Now what do I do as a Buddha? Seems to me that's the kind of structure, you might say, of his religious quest. And it seems to me the answer is, if you're a Buddha, start acting like a Buddha. Start behaving like a Buddha. Now, I don't mean this just in a behavioral sense. Start, you know, doing. But the model of the Buddha's lifestyle became key to him. What he discovered in Zen Buddhism was not so much some new doctrine. What he discovered was a tradition that preserved the style of an actual Buddha. Someone, a real Buddha who had lived in the world and who had behaved in a certain way. By becoming a monk, and I mean, in his idea of Shakyamuni's life, he became a monk and he practiced a certain lifestyle. He just gave himself over to that. He said, this is what Buddhas do. I'm a Buddha, therefore I do it. And that is our way of being Buddha. That is my solution. I commit myself to that tradition. That's one reason, it seems to me, why the lineage is so important for Dogen. Committing yourself to the lineage and the practices of the people who belong to that community is itself to be a Buddha, to practice and be. And if you're looking for something more than that, you miss the point. I think some structure like that is the way I, at least recently, have come to think about it. Yeah, one way of thinking about it, and this is something that Dogen shares with people of his time, a shift from a spatial model of how to orient yourself to a historical model. The people of his time were thinking very seriously, how can we be Buddhists in this time? I mean, they're thinking of themselves as moderns, right? Seems ironic to us, but other people will think of us as being silly, thinking of ourselves as moderns at some point. We're moderns, that's an ancient religion, and how can we now, under very different circumstances, so removed from India and from the culture of the Buddha and the, what you might call, spiritual power of the Buddha, how can we now be Buddhists? In other words, they located themselves historically and asking what's appropriate. And you see that in the rise of Pure Land Buddhism, the rise of reformed Tendai, like Nichiren Buddhism. Lots of people asking the same question. I think Dogen was asking it and answering it also in historical terms. By recognizing that there is, that the world around us, including the mountains and rivers, is a historical world. And we are situated in history. And we need to be in the present is not just to be here and now, but also to be there and then in some kind of conversation with the past that has set a model or a set of examples for us as how we don't have to make it up new. We inherit it, and we can, if we give ourselves to that inheritance, to that heritage, and live it out and pass it on, then we are, you might say, grounded in the Buddha, in a Buddha world, rather than the notion beneath the surface somehow, or in a, you know, in the other world, there's a Buddha world that we can try to express through ritual practice. It was now much more reenacting a script, you might say, become the players in a long-going historical drama of Buddha. Is that?
Yeah. When we locate ourselves in history as modern people and as modern part of the world, what does the Mountains and Waters Sutra, what can we deduce from that as to how we should treat and use the landscape given
Anybody? I don't have any brilliant insights from this, but you people who live at Tassahara, and you have help for us city folk. Have you read Gary Snyder's poem? You might, if you're interested in this issue, you might look at it. Because one of the remarkable things about Gary Snyder's poem is that although it's ostensibly about mountains, like this text, it does something that overcomes the distinction between nature and culture. That is to say, Gary is remarkable. Take a famous poem that I read as a kid back in the 60s, Bub Creek's Bub's Creek Haircut. Anybody read that poem? to Kuopun. It juxtaposes his preparation for going into the wilderness up Bubbs Creek in Kings Canyon National Park with a haircut that he got on Howard Street back in San Francisco and the Goodwill store that used to be near the barbershop where he went. And he talks about cultural artifacts in the basement of the Goodwill store. And then he jumps from there back and forth between that very cultural experience of human artifacts into the wilderness. And he keeps jumping back and forth like this. That's a very early and powerful expression of a sense that he has of trying somehow to overcome our sense of guilt about being cultural beings. I mean, most people have not felt that their cultures were a violation of the natural world. You need to have so much cultural, industrial power that you start to destroy things before you become guilty, feel guilty, and feel so alienated, right, that your cities are a blight on the landscape. Most people had such small settlements that they were part of the landscape and they didn't feel this sense of, oh my God, I'm evil somehow because I am a culture producer. And Gary, I think, is urging us back in many ways to that sense, even in New York. You know, he has a poem about New York City, the landscape of New York City. So he has a sense of trying to overcome this sense of guilt, that if we're going to be ecological beings, we have to accept that our culture is natural in some way. Take that seriously and think how our culture can work as a natural thing and not something that we're ashamed of and we sort of try to block and prevent from spreading too far, like a cancer. So he has a very accepting sense of humans' unnaturalness. So much so that in this seminar, there were people protesting. He said, Gary Snyder is copping out on the ecology movement by this, celebrating, you know, the landscape and the old tires from the side of the highway as themselves somehow beautiful and natural. He talks about the carcasses of old tires along the highway in the same way he talks about a flower, you know, in the mountains. It's just beautiful. And he says that kind of non-discriminating Zen beauty undercuts the political movement to protect the landscape from tire carcasses. And he's abrogating his moral responsibility. And it's an interesting kind of debate. And I think it's in some sense we feel in Zen Buddhism. On the one hand, we're told all the time, accept whatever comes. So does that mean if I'm at Auschwitz, you know, a guard at Auschwitz, I accept whatever comes? You know, how do we fit into the landscape and yet take a stand, you know, some kind of moral, responsible stand? It's, you know, it's a perennial question. I don't think this text has, you know, the answer. But it does provide, it seems to me, at least three ways in which we could think about nature and culture and the relationship to each other. And I'm not sure they would be necessarily conducive to the sorts of needs we feel for protecting the landscape. You know, Buddhists have not been ecologists, they've been included. For ecology and environmentalism, you need a lot of Western baggage. I mean, you need the biological sciences. You need an industrial revolution that poses the issue and for the first time gives us good reasons for taking seriously what might happen if we didn't treat nature. And you need a certain, if you'll pardon the expression, Christian sense of our stewardship over the earth that Buddhists don't have. Bodhisattvas do not. They may want to save all sentient beings, but they do not have that sense that they were put on earth to take care of the animals and of nature, that this is a kind of garden for humans. But without that, you're just another player. You're no more responsibility than the dog or the cat. Or, you know. So it's not a Buddhist thing that we're talking about here. We're talking about something else that we need now to find. We need somehow to grasp that together with our Buddhist thing. We're going to have to create something new the way Dogen did, you know.
I thought we're mentioning some of the philosophies
Yeah, and there was a big fight over that too. because Native Americans have said, oh yeah, the white shaman. Right? In other words, you're appropriating our native lore for some kind of middle-class white boy's trip. You know, now that you've conquered the place, you can sort of appreciate us. You can't win in this game, right? I mean, so you're always going to be stepping on somebody. And other people said, no. What Gary's trying to do there is to give what he calls Turtle Island. He calls North America Turtle Island from some old Indian expression for it. Trying to give this place back to people as an inhabited landscape with its own lore. Give us a larger sense of the history of this place. It didn't just begin with shooting buffalo and Indians and so on. But that the place itself has a long sacred history that can be sort of appreciated if you understand the people who lived here and how they sacralized it. Yeah. You don't think it is about nature? Yeah. Well, you know, at one point after I studied, he told me, you know, why don't you look at this text? So I started looking at it, right? And it's very difficult. And so I came to him and I said, wait a second, this is way over my head. And he said, yes, this is a very difficult, interesting text. And I said, yeah, the language of it is so hard to understand. And he said, it's not the language, kid. It's the thought. But this isn't just poetry. It's the philosophy that makes it make sense that's very difficult to understand. And so I think he saw it as, you know, somehow, not a philosophy in the, you know, abstract or technical sense, but as a text very rich in Buddhist thought. And, I mean, what a shame that he died without giving a commentary to it. You know, he was going to give a regular series of lectures at Tathagata on it to the whole text. It would have been fantastic. Better than Sandokaya. Yeah. Yeah, they are. Yeah. Well, I can't remember all the details of Kusara Kiyan Roshi was a Zen master who lectured for many years on this book. That is the whole Shobo Genzo. And Suzuki Roshi heard many of those lectures personally. In those commentaries, they're fairly standard, I would say. That is to say, they talk about the philosophy of change, of being in the present, and so on. They don't talk about mandalas, and they don't talk about legends and that sort of thing. They're what I would call a kind of modern sort of theological take on the meaning of the text. This stuff that I was talking about is my own Cracker Barrel, you know, interpretation. It's not a traditional. You wouldn't, no. Well, although, I mean, I take some solace in the fact, for example, going back to the question that Vicky was asking, or what she, the relationship between the Soto Zen tradition and the more tantric stuff. Vicky, actually, I remember saying at the time, I had no idea what on earth he meant by it. He said, Soto and Shingon are brothers. Shingon is the closest form of Buddhism to Soto Zen. And Shingon is the Mantrayana, the tantric school of Buddhism in Japan. So he may have, you know, might not have said this. He didn't talk this way in his own lectures, but, you know, he might have nodded and said, yeah, at a shallow level, I suppose you can say that, you know. <That's the laughs> And when I said to him, isn't this a bit stupid for someone like me to be translating something so much deeper and richer than... And he said, yep. Get on with it. take a nap.